In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When sweet tarts dared to combine sweet and tart, they thought, why stop there? Why not create other exciting and unexpected combinations, like rainbows and ropes, or fruity and gummy, or chewy and more chewy? That's why they created fun treats like Sweet Tarts Twisted Rainbow Ropes, Gummies Fruity Splits, and Chewy Fusions. When you dare to combine, it's sure to blow your mind. Sweet Tarts, dare to combine. Visit SweetTartsCandy.com to shop now.
Hello and welcome to Life of the Week from History Extra, where leading historians delve into the lives of history's most intriguing and significant figures. Famously branded as mad, bad, and dangerous to know, Lord Byron captured the imagination and attention of early 19th century Britain with his soul-bearing poetry, decadent lifestyle, and torrid love affairs. In today's Life of the Week episode, Ellie Cawthorne speaks to broadcaster and academic Corin Throsby about how the romantic poet became the era's most scandalous celebrity.
Thanks so much for joining me today, Corin. We're going to be talking about the life and legacy of Lord Byron. So the 19th of April this year marks the 200th anniversary of Byron's death. Why are we still talking about him all these years on?
Well, he was one of the greatest British poets. He was part of the Romantic movement. And even though a lot of people don't know his poetry necessarily, they do know a bit about his persona that he created in his life. I think the quote that people most know is actually from one of his ex-lovers, where she describes him as mad, bad, and dangerous to know. And so he's interesting in that he created this character, or he certainly popularized a character that we know as the Byronic hero, of the kind of brooding, misunderstood bad boy that's still in pop culture. He's also remembered as one of the first celebrities. And so the work that I do is looking at early fan culture and celebrity culture and looking at what was happening at that particular time when Byron was writing that made this huge phenomenon happen, which was Byronism, this sort of mania surrounding Byron.
So he is a really fascinating figure to begin to unpick. I just want to pick you up on that quote, mad, bad, and dangerous to know. How did he earn that reputation? And does he deserve it?
Yeah, I guess he does deserve it. I mean, he was someone who was never shy of drawing attention to himself. We see this right from the beginning of his life. When he went to Cambridge, for example, he's famous for bringing a bear to college with him because he wasn't allowed to bring a dog. And he was so outraged at this that he brought a bear instead and joked that it might be sitting for a fellowship. So he was someone who enjoyed attention, consciously created scandal around himself. But then he also had times of really wanting to withdraw from public society. You know, it's that classic thing that we also get with celebrities today where they will create something and court attention, and then actually it sort of gets out of their control in ways that they don't like. And the same was true of Byron.
Let's rewind now to the beginning of this story, to Byron's early life. What can you tell us about that?
Well, he was very proud of his Scottish heritage, but he was actually born in London to a Scottish mother and an English father. Then the family moved up to Aberdeen, his mother's hometown. His father was a scoundrel and a cad and a rake, and he spent the family's fortune. He really married Byron's mother for her money, spent her inheritance, and then buggered off. But he died when Byron was three, but he was out of the picture by then anyway. And so Byron was brought up actually in kind of not poverty, but relatively humble beginnings with a single mother struggling in Aberdeen. And then his fortunes changed when he was 10 years old, when he found out through a series of sort of unexpected deaths that he was inheriting his seat, and he became a Lord Byron, and Newstead Abbey, which was the Byron family estate near Nottingham, became his. And it was in a state of relative disrepair. The previous Lord Byron hadn't been keeping it well. So he inherited this kind of Gothic, already crumbling mansion in sort of true poetic style. I mean, so much of his life feels like a story, that he had this, you know, rags to riches, single mother in Aberdeen, and then his Lord Byron. And it's quite a stark contrast.
All of this, as you say, probably added a bit to his mystique and the myth of Lord Byron. He then went on to Harrow and Cambridge. Obviously, he went on to be a great distinguished poet, but did he distinguish himself as a scholar while he was there?
He did almost nothing in Cambridge. I mean, he really wasn't a distinguished scholar at all. In those days, noblemen didn't actually have to attend any lectures or classes, so he did basically nothing. But Cambridge was a great place for him to meet friends. It really became a place where he met like-minded people, and several of his friends from that time were friends for life, including a guy called John Cam Hobhouse, who went on to be a Whig MP, who was, you know, one of his sort of greatest friends. So he had a fantastic time in Cambridge and started to enjoy some of the excesses that became associated with him throughout his life. There was lots of partying. He famously fell in love with a male chorister. And so this was also a time when he was exploring sexuality in a different way. And yeah, it was a very kind of formative time for him, and one that he always looked back on as being a really golden era in his life.
And that question of Byron's sexuality and romantic liaisons is one that I definitely want to return to in a little bit. But I wonder if you could give us a sense of how he ended up making all these kind of influential, important connections. Was he a pretty magnetic figure? It sounds like it.
Hugely. I mean, if you read, I can say this, having read all of his letters, we don't have his memoirs. They were famously burnt by his publisher and friends after his death in what was described as one of the greatest literary crimes in history. So what we have from him are his letters, and they are so funny, so brilliant, so hilarious. I mean, there are 13 volumes of them, so it's quite a commitment to actually read through them. But if you can get a selection of his letters, there are a few out there. He really leaps off the page as just being a very charismatic, funny, a very loyal friend. He was not great in his romantic relationships, as we will go on to see. He could be extremely cruel, but he was a really, truly wonderful friend, and so people flocked around him.
So how did he go from this layabout nobleman at Cambridge to transform himself into one of the era's most influential literary figures? What was his first hit, as it were?
Well, he wasn't doing nothing. He wasn't exactly laying about in Cambridge. He was starting to write poetry. He started writing poetry fairly young, and so he was writing, and then his first volume of poetry had lukewarm reviews, particularly from the Scottish press, and he wrote a response, sort of having a go at all the people who had a go at him. And that got quite a lot of attention. But the first poem that made him famous actually came a little bit later, after he'd taken what we might describe as a gap year now, but was then known as the Grand Tour, which was the trip that lots of young noblemen took to better their education, to see great art and antiquities. Usually they went through France and Italy, or that was the focus. Byron went further east, all the way to Albania. And during that time, he wrote a poem called Childe Harold's Pilgrimage. When he returned, he sort of wrote up these travels. And yeah, and that was the poem that he says, I awoke to find myself famous. It really felt like overnight success for him, that the poem was a huge hit.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Well, can you tell us about Childe Harold's Pilgrimage? Why was it such a hit?
Funnily enough, for a modern reader, it's not the easiest read. There's a lot of description of countryside. But if you imagine British readers at the time, who most, by far, you know, the most of whom had not been to the continent, had certainly not been to the east, so to Turkey and to Albania. So he was feeding an appetite for travel literature as much as anything else and wanting to know about places abroad. But more than that, he created this figure of Childe Harold, which many took as a thinly veiled description of himself, as this brooding, misunderstood, dark nobleman. And people really responded to this character. And this was the character that he would then go on to recreate in his next poems. You know, he was onto a good thing with this character, and he sort of repurposed it in various ways through his next poems, which are known as the Turkish Tales, where again, we see this sort of dark, misunderstood, brooding nobleman, you know, who has a great true love and sort of loves deeply, but is scorned by society.
Well, he clearly hit a nerve, touched on something that culture was really after at a certain time. I wonder if you could give us a bit of a broader view of what was going on in terms of culture and literature at the time and where Byron sits in that.
When we think about why Byron became so famous and why his work was so popular, there are a few things going on. First of all, there were changes in the way the printing industry was working. It really wasn't that long before Byron that people were reading hand-printed books by authors that they very possibly knew personally. There was a very small number of readers. During Byron's lifetime, the numbers of readers exploded due to mass literacy, but more importantly, the amount of printed matter grew exponentially due to mechanized printing. So there was all of a sudden this huge amount of literature to read and the ability to mass produce literature and reach a far wider audience. So there's just this fact that Byron was being read by more people than ever before. And in that context, he was able to create a sense for readers that felt very personal. So they were in this kind of depersonalized marketplace now with like all of these, you know, authors that they didn't know. And Byron was able in his poetry with these sort of little asides to the reader and little nods to them that made them feel that they knew him personally. And this thing of giving some of himself away. He was one of the first authors to use his own portrait as a frontispiece for his work. So people were able to kind of see the description of the character, look at the picture of him, you know, make that association. And so there was this real feeling amongst his readers that he was speaking directly to them. And that was very appealing.
Yeah, I think this connection between his persona on the one hand and his work on the other is really interesting. Do you think people would have been so interested in his poetry if it wasn't him that had created it? Does his work stand on its own two feet if it wasn't by Byron?
That's a great question. I mean, I think a lot of it does, of course, does stand on its own. He was a really fantastic writer, but it's impossible to separate them now, that it was so part of his creation of self and character that the two were so blurred, and his sort of performance, particularly in his years of fame when he lived in London. Yeah, it's really hard to separate the two. And I think that when we think about the burgeoning celebrity culture, that association was really interesting, that conflation that people had where they felt that reading his poetry offered access to his personal thoughts.
So as you say, Byron himself basically described Childe Harold as transforming him into a celebrity overnight. Can you talk a bit about his experience as a celebrity, especially back in England? How was he seen by society?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are famous reports of, you know, women shielding their daughters' eyes as he walked past because just looking on him would make them faint. There was this thing that his wife later termed Byromania, where people couldn't get enough of him, but that he was also seen as dangerous. And, you know, this was, his poetry was sort of risque in a lot of ways and seen as being certainly not reading material for women. And he capitalized on that, and he had lots of very public affairs, including the famous one with Lady Caroline Lamb, who was then married to Lord Melbourne, who would become Prime Minister. And she was also into kind of performance. And so there were lots of, you know, very public scenes between the two of them where she would, you know, cut herself to get his attention, and also private scenes. You know, she sent him some of her bloodied pubic hair in the mail. It was all very, very dramatic and a little bit gothic and stagey. I mean, I think there's a sense that they really did love each other in the beginning, but it was a very short affair that didn't really mean that much, certainly not to Byron, but has become, because of all of the sort of letters and myth surrounding it, has become much bigger in the imagination.
I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about some of Byron's other affairs. Obviously, having affairs with married women was pretty out there at the time, or publicly doing so. Or was it?
Yes and no. I think that actually in the aristocracy at that time it happened, but I think it was about sort of doing it in a way that didn't draw attention to it, that it was happening a lot, that there was sort of, you know, in a lot of marriages, there was this assumption that there would be affairs, but that the idea was that you should keep them discreet. So that Byron didn't do that was definitely scandalous. He was also in a relationship with his half-sister. We don't know for sure, but we're pretty sure that that relationship was sexual. He joked that when he went to visit one of his half-sister's children, he was checking to see if she looked like an ape, because that was the theory at the time, that children of incest would look like monkeys. So he kind of, there are enough hints that the relationship was sexual that we're pretty sure that it was. And certainly his wife thought it was. And yeah, so, I mean, that's about as scandalous as you can get, really. There were definitely whisperings about it. And yeah, it was for sure taboo then. And, but even more perhaps was that he had potentially had relationships with men, that then, you know, homosexuality was seen as not an identity, but an act, the act of sodomy, which was a capital crime. And so that really, in a sense, from a legal standpoint, was more serious than incest. And so, yeah, that was, you know, he was really seen as sexually scandalous.
And are relationships with men something that carried on throughout Byron's life? You mentioned, obviously, the relationship that he had at Cambridge, but did that follow him through his life?
Yes, it did. I mean, it's always difficult to talk about Byron's sexuality because, as I said, that he wasn't thinking about sexuality in the same way that we do. But he did have relationships with men. It's hard to know for sure, again, because it was a capital crime. He wasn't able to ever say that it was always through coded language that we're making assumptions that these were happening. But there were a few relationships. But then he also had a lot of sex with women. So, you know, this question of whether if Byron were alive today, how he would identify, it's impossible to know, but probably bisexual or pansexual or poly, you know, that it's, he was definitely interested in having sex with both genders.
So as you've alluded to throughout our conversation, Byron did also have a wife. Can you tell us about this unhappy union? I think it's fair to say.
It was an unhappy union. It was motivated, you know, Byron was in the midst of this scandal, the sort of whisperings about his life, his private life, and things were feeling out of control in terms of his public reputation. And marrying seems like a great solution to this. Plus, he was in financial dire straits, and the woman that he married, Annabella Milbank, was an heiress who came with a handsome dowry, and she had quite elderly parents. Her dad was in his 60s, so there was a sense that she might be inheriting soon. And she was the niece of a very close friend and confidant of Byron's. And she came at a time when he needed a lifeline in various ways, and she seemed to fulfill that. And they had quite a lengthy correspondence that was really rather lovely and had an intellectual connection. She's gone down in history, I think, in quite a sexist way as being kind of boring and a bit prudish. And she obviously wasn't right for Byron, but She was a completely brilliant woman who went on to be into prison reform, education reform. She was an abolitionist. She was very clever, engaged, politically active, fascinating person. And she was also very into maths. Byron called her the Princess of Parallelograms. And so they've been presented in this dichotomy. You know, there's the bad boy, good girl. She was sort of very do-gooder throughout her life. And it's very tempting to sort of see them as these polar opposites. You know, he's artistic and tempestuous, and she's cold and mathematical. And they got married. It was a disaster right from the beginning. You know, the whole relationship has again been the subject of so much speculation and conjecture that it's hard to really know what, you know, we can't know what happened. But for whatever reason, it completely broke down almost immediately. Byron regretted, I guess. And then in that year that they were married, really seemed to have almost a nervous breakdown. That was certainly Lady Byron's take on it. And he was having affairs and fits of rage, and it was a very, very unhappy marriage, intermingled with some quite lovely moments where, you know, if it was all a total disaster, it would somehow make more sense. But actually, a lot of their letters from that time are really rather sweet and beautiful, and they clearly did have a physical connection and sort of loved each other. But in the end, Byron's histrionics got too much and she filed for separation, and they were separated. I think it was just over a year that they were married before they were legally separated.
And they did have a daughter together, Ada Lovelace, known as a pioneering mind in computing. That's where people might recognise that name from. Did Byron and his daughter have any kind of relationship?
They didn't, in the sense that he left the country forever when she was 3 months old. So they never saw each other again after her very, very young infancy. He thought about her a lot. He wrote about her. So it wasn't like she was out of his mind at all. But unfortunately, they didn't get to spend any time together after that.
So he left the country forever. I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about his life on the continent.
Yes, so he moves to Europe. He starts first in Switzerland. He takes a house on Lake Geneva. And this is quite a famous house, quite a famous period in his life, where he is visited by Percy Bysshe Shelley, another famous romantic poet, and his then girlfriend, soon to be wife, Mary Shelley, then Mary Godwin. And the thing that brought them together was Mary's stepsister, Claire Claremont, had been one of Byron's fans in his years of fame in London. And in fact, they had had sex and she was pregnant with his child. And she really desperately wanted that relationship to work and wanted to be with Byron. And so she convinced, very easily convinced, Shelley and Mary to come and see Byron in Switzerland. And there they had a famous meeting of minds, and it was the stormiest, coldest summer, because a year earlier, a volcano had erupted in Indonesia, and this had caused kind of disrupted weather patterns. And so the gang spent a lot of time indoors, sheltering from the storms. And one evening, Byron suggested that they tell ghost stories, and they were reading from a book of ghost stories. And out of that evening, Mary didn't tell the story on the night, but she went away and it sort of sparked what would become the very famous novel Frankenstein. And also that night, Byron told a story about vampires, because he'd been in Greece where they have vampire legends. And that spawned a story where another friend who was there, his doctor, John Polidori, wrote that story into a novella, turned that story into a novella, and was called The Vampire. And that was the direct inspiration for Bram Stoker's Dracula. So Byron was very much part of vampires becoming seen as this sort of beautiful, pale aristocrat, that image that we have now of vampires. Before that, they'd been kind of gross little hairy monsters. And yeah, so he's part of that whole literary moment as well.
Yeah, it's such an amazing moment to be part of this axis, basically, between romanticism and the gothic. As you say, we have vampires and Frankenstein emerging out of it, and of course the Byronic hero. So what else did Byron get up to in his travels across Europe?
Well, I should say as well that in Switzerland, this meeting with Shelley also produced some fantastic poetry. He really had a very creative time then and was writing what could be called like very sort of true romantic poetry through the influence of Shelley. He then, soon after that, moved to Venice and spent a sort of significant period of time in Venice and was starting then to lead a more debauched life again, that he really was sleeping with a lot of people and leading a very kind of excessive life. He famously had a menagerie of animals. I mean, just an incredible list of animals lived in his house with him. So again, this kind of very extra flamboyant life that he led. And in Venice, he really started to explore a different mode of writing, in which he started to write comedy. And it was during this time that he started writing what is considered his masterpiece, which is a poem called Don Juan. He's making a joke there about how badly British people pronounce foreign words. It's based on the Don Juan myth. And this poem would take romantic tropes and then make fun of them. And so this is really kind of an interesting place that Byron was now occupying in the kind of romantic scene, where he was both presenting romantic ideals and then making fun of it as well. And it's a really fantastic poem. An example is that in the first canto of this poem, Don Juan is on a boat and reading a kind of lofty love letter from his great love. But as he reads it, he can't stop throwing up from seasickness. So there's this kind of thing where the body always gets in the way with these later Byronic works. And just as we're in a kind of transcendent moment, he brings it back down to earth. And that letter actually ends up getting torn up and used as the sailors run out of food to draw lots to see who's going to get eaten first. So there's a bit of like cannibalism there as well.
So if Childe Harold is the poem that made him famous and Don Juan is widely regarded as his masterpiece, what I want to know, though, Corinne, is what is your favourite piece of Byron's work?
I mean, Don Juan is brilliant. It has to be my favourite. It's so great. I also really love a poem, or a poem that always strikes me as very modern, is a poem called Darkness. It's one of Byron's shorter poems. So I encourage everyone to go and have a look at it. And it is about a kind of nightmarish apocalypse of the world. It's really a vision of environmental breakdown. So it feels very contemporary. And I'd say that's probably maybe my favorite after Don Juan. And The Prisoner of Chillon is another one that I love, that he wrote during his time in Switzerland with Shelley, about a prisoner who is in the most awful circumstances, but through a little slit of window, imagines the beautiful Alps that are sitting just beyond his prison cell. And that I always find extremely beautiful and moving. But he's really prolific. There's so much good stuff, but they're probably my favourites.
Well, thanks. Listeners can go away and check those out. So by 1823, Byron had got himself involved in the War of Greek Independence. Can you tell us a bit about what was going on and why he was drawn to that conflict?
Byron had throughout his life been fairly politically active. He had progressive politics. His first speech in the House of Lords was defending the local weavers in Nottingham who had been protesting against new technology that was replacing them by breaking weaving frames. And this was a crime punishable by death. And so Byron was arguing that that was too harsh a penalty. When he was in Italy as well, he was involved in the Italian nationalist movement. So he was no stranger to particularly underdog political causes. And he had always loved Greece. He'd gone there during his grand tour, had always loved Greek literature and antiquity. And he was drawn to their cause. And it corresponded with a time in his life when he was feeling, again, sort of out of control with his excesses, that he had settled into a very happy relationship, perhaps his longest and happiest relationship, with a woman called Teresa Guiccioli, an Italian woman. But he'd slightly started to stagnate in that and was getting a little bit bored. You know, his whole life, he was always moving. He's really never in one place for very long. And there was just this sense that at this time he wanted to do something meaningful with his life. And he felt like the Greeks needed him. And he was right. He actually was able to help them financially. Certainly, that was a huge part of the contribution he made. He was really thinking that he would be going in a humanitarian capacity rather than in a military capacity. And yeah, so through his prestige and fame and the fact that he was an international celebrity, he was able to bring attention to the Greek cause in a way which, you know, really did help with their battle.
Did he end up fighting at all?
He did not. He did not. He bought a very fancy helmet, like sort of military helmet, when he went. And there was sort of this sense that he had the costume. But how much he was actually imagining, he was really imagining himself more as a, he first described himself as he'd go and be a reporter. And then in this kind of humanitarian capacity, I think he would have been prepared to fight. And there was that sense that he might have been about to go into battle, certainly in a kind of leadership role. But he sadly went for a horse ride and got extremely drenched while he was there in Messalonghi, which is famously quite a marshy, swampy area. And he caught a fever. We don't know if it was, it could have been malaria or something else, and was extremely ill. And his illness was handled very badly by his doctors. There was still a sense then that disease was in the blood and that the blood need to be let. And even though Byron protested against this, they ended up letting, historians think, 2 liters of Byron's blood through leaching and various other means. So we don't know whether it seems like that could have been what actually killed him rather than the illness itself. But yeah, very sadly, we don't know if Byron ever would have fought because he died before he got the opportunity.
And yeah, he died at the age of 36. What was the response in Europe, but also back in Britain?
There was a huge response. There are lots of accounts of Byron's funeral as being a real moment for a lot of writers, particularly, that no one could really believe. He'd been such a huge figure that there was a lot of disbelief that he could have died. His body went back to England in an iron coffin, and even though he had actually wanted to be buried in Greece, but there was a sense from his friends that he should be buried in England. And John Cam Hobhouse, his best friend, tried to get him buried at Westminster Abbey, but he was considered too scandalous for that honour. And so he ended up being buried in Hucknall in Nottinghamshire near his family seat. And there was a ticketed event to go and see his grave. And before he was interred, and really at that point in his career, Don Juan had been a massive hit with sort of general readers. He was really popular with quote unquote ordinary man and woman. The poet John Clare writes about going to Byron's funeral and the funeral procession, should I say. The streets were lined with people, and he comments that it was just ordinary people wanting to pay respects to him. So yeah, he didn't get a kind of glamorous state funeral, of course, because he was considered too controversial, but it was clear that he'd had a big impact.
Definitely. And I think in the 2 centuries since his death, that impact has continued to be felt. What do you think is Byron's biggest impact on British culture, and how should we remember him today?
Yeah, he has been remembered, but then it's funny because, you know, I think not many British people can actually quote any of his poetry. And he hasn't been studied in British schools. You know, he hasn't been on the curriculum. And so people don't know him in the way that they know, for example, Keats. His poetry doesn't lend itself necessarily to being studied in that way because so much of it is so long, so political, often mentioning people of the time that, you know, don't have relevance now. But that's not to say that, I think lots of his poetry does lend itself to school-aged study. But I think that the thing that he can most be remembered for is, I think it's the Byronic hero has become such a staple of popular culture that the misunderstood outsider, we all know that character, and Byron did such an amazing job of bringing that to popular attention. I also think that there's a lot to be rediscovered in Byron's work, that he was such a different figure in the Romantic period, in that he was able to take a step back from what was going on and laugh at it and comment on it in a way that felt so fresh and, again, modern. You know, I think he's a really modern figure. He was sexually ambiguous. He was a real traveler. You know, his work is international in a way that someone like Jane Austen just is very British. And he was also politically really brave. Even though he had this kind of dissolute life and this life of excess, in the end, he was about living life to its full and doing everything that you can to make the world better. Yeah, just living life for every moment.
Finally, I would just ask, what are some of the biggest myths you come across in the public perception of Byron that you have to counter as a historian?
Oh, there are so many. I mean, he was someone who was so surrounded by myth and was involved in his own myth making. So it's very hard to kind of disentangle him from that. But I think the biggest misperception is that the Byronic hero, certainly of his earlier work, is very dark and broody. And he certainly had that element to his personality. But really, he was so lovely and politically engaged and really a sort of very complex, insecure person in a lot of ways. And so I think that that sense that all he cared about was seduction is not quite fair. He was a man of many contrasts. As soon as you try and pin him down in one way, he evades that. So it's whenever anyone says, oh, I'll tell you about Byron, Byron was like this, there's always at least 10 counterpoints. So yeah, he's a very difficult person to pin down. That's what makes him so great.
That was Corin Throsby. Corin is a broadcaster and academic. She's also the presenter of BBC Radio 3 and is currently writing a novel about Mary Shelley.